77 WABC. And now, the longest-running program in the history of 77 WABC, Religion on the Line with Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Religion Online. I am Rabbi Potasnik, and this has been an interesting week. I've seen many miracles during my lifetime, but Mr. Crogliano, to see the Red Sox win three in a row in Houston is something I never thought I would ever see. They say before the Messiah arrives, or as some of you believe, arrives again, you're going to see miraculous things, and wow, unbelievable. And look, I was a chaplain when I first began as a rabbi, so for the Yankee fans listening, I'm here for you. You know, whatever comfort I can bring to you, I'm ready to do. But it's really been quite a series. And of course, now we look on to the World Series. Let me share something with you that it's painful to talk about, and yet it has to be spoken about. So this past week, notorious anti-Semite hate monger Louis Farrakhan said he was anti-termite, referred to the Jews as termites. And I don't expect better from him. He's not going to change at this stage of his life. He's a consistent hate monger. He's a chronic hate monger. What I do expect is for people of conscience, I don't care what the political affiliation or the religious affiliation or no affiliation, is to come forward and condemn him soundly, not to ignore it, not to be selective that we only condemn certain people, we're silent when others. It doesn't matter, who expresses the hate. But when it comes to Farrakhan, I'd like to hear a chorus of condemnation. I don't at the present time. I've heard here and there some people, but I would think, at least let's get political party leaders stand together. They rarely stand together for anything. But certainly they can, find this moment as an important one to say, this is morally unacceptable. This is wrong. This is offensive. We, stand on the opposite side of this man. And the fact that he goes by the name of Reverend is even more offensive, because supposedly he's, to have some value system within. There's no value system here. This is a person who is, without any moral fiber. So I just think it's shameful, but it's also shocking that more people have not spoken. I don't know what risks one has, what risk is there to stand against someone who espouses this kind of view? What are you losing by, what you're losing is credibility, because how can anybody have faith in you, your leadership, as a political leader, if you don't come forward at this time? We can all find issues that we call in Yiddish parve or neutral. It's very easy to stand up there, and talk about, well, we need more protein in our diets or whatever. That's easy. But to stand up against not just hatred, but the hate monger, specifically the hate monger, we can all say we're against hatred. Stand up against the hate monger. That requires, unfortunately, for some courage, and that courage is missing. I'm really, I'm ashamed. When I see the absence of courage. When we come back, we're going to be speaking with Reverend A.R. Bernard, who is the founder and senior leader of the Christian Cultural Center. Later on in the program, we'll be speaking with NYPD Commissioner James P. O'Neill. So these are two great interviews, I think, that you're going to find today very, very meaningful. This portion of Religion Online is brought to you by Sherman's Flatbush Memorial Chapel.
77 WABC. Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, celebrating 35 years of Religion on the Line on 77 WABC.
During my years as a rabbi, I've been privileged to meet many people, people of all different faiths, some of no faith. One of the most special individuals I've ever encountered is Reverend A.R. Bernard, who's the founder and senior leader of the Christian Cultural Center, which presently has over 40,000 members. That's 40,000 members. I don't know how many members of our clergy can make that claim, but obviously he's doing something very unique there to attract so many people. And I think after you hear him speak today, and those of us who've heard him many times understand why he has such a large following. Good evening, Reverend Bernard.
Ah, good evening, my friend. Always good to be with you.
Always good to be with you. You know, I tell people, you and I speak, I think at least 3 to 4 times, sometimes daily, many more weekly, but it's always, I always learn from you, and I think one of the things we all need to understand is you surround yourself with people with great minds, and you learn from them, because none of us has all the answers. Maybe together we'll find more answers, but it's important to surround. We teach our kids, when you choose friends, get people, you know, people who are of substance, because that's an important kind of connection. So thank you. Thank you for all you've done over the years and continue to do. I want to know, as many want to know, what's the answer? What is it you're doing that maybe others could emulate or modify in some way? You know, I just came back from Israel and talking with religious leaders, and people are all saying, how do we get those millennials through the doors? So many of them are just not connecting with community until there's a crisis, you know, or some major celebration. But if you had to give some advice, what would you suggest?
I think you gave the most important word. We don't grow in isolation. We grow in community. And this generation, although somewhat disconnected from community but connected technologically, is realizing that we are social beings. They're realizing the solidarity of the human family and that the church has been, you know, so important, so critical in fostering family and the principles and values that govern family and how it is the foundation for society and the whole idea of community within our houses of worship and communities of faith, where we are socialized into shared values, respect, dignity, which is some of the things that we are really suffering a dearth from, especially in our society today.
And, you know, if you're not going to find it, if you don't find the community meaningful, you live in this bubble, you know, or an echo chamber. We need each other. We need to communicate, to cooperate. We need to lean on one another for support. You know, you just can't get it online all the time.
Exactly. You can't. And you know, the common good and the principle of the common good, which we share as one of our values and even one of our social ethics, can only be improved on and fulfilled when we are in community. If we are individuals in an ethos of radical individualism, pursuing our own good and not the common good, society suffers, community breaks down, and unfortunately, we begin to dehumanize the human person.
And you find, as I've learned over the years, that millennials will come forward and say, you know, I was on the wrong path. I thought I could do it differently. I looked at my friends, and, you know, they were individualistic. And then I recognized there was a void, a spiritual void, other voids, but I needed people in my life, and it wasn't just sufficient to surround myself with the same 4 people or whatever.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah, it's true. I mean, you know, we go back to the 60s and the baby boomers and that decade of many revolutions, and we felt the need to change the system, to challenge the establishment. But interestingly enough, the majority of us who challenged the system back in those days are now today working in the system to make change because we understand the importance of it.
I remember there's a congressman you and I know, and he said when he first started in Congress, he challenged the seniority system. It's unfair, you know, keeps us out. He says, as I get older, I realize that what a great system that is, how important it is to have those of us who are older making recommendations and putting us in charge in certain places because we have some wisdom. And, you know, that's the definition of good judgment. You get it by bad judgment, the mistakes you made, and you learn to improve on them. And, you know, when you're in community, you have those exchanges, and you learn what you've done wrong and what you could do better. And together, you
absolutely. We all contribute in some way. That's what community is about. No one is the total package. We need each other's gifts. In the beginning of the program, you talked about how much you've benefited from your relationship with me, but it's mutually beneficial. I have benefited in so many ways in my relationship with you, iron sharpening iron. You know, the absence of concern or sensitivity to the common good, that's a sure sign, Rabbi, of a society in need of health. Because as a sense of community erodes, concern for the common good declines. And proper community concern is the antidote to unbridled individualism.
So if I'm attending a service at Christian Cultural Center, and I'm Christian, what is it that you do that seems to resonate with so many people? Because I know members of your congregation, and some say, I like the music, I like the message, and I'm sure all of those things contribute, but there's more than that. I mean, it's not just going to a concert. It's not just going to a lecture. So what is it that happens in that context at CCC, as you call it, that reaches so many people?
Well, you know, it goes back to a study that was done by two Harvard professors back in 1998, and they were predicting the future. They said that we were moving from a product and services-based economy to an experience-based economy fueled by products and services. And that, which is true economically in society at large, has also come into the church. People judge by what they experience when they attend a worship service, when they are involved in any of the programming offered. We see a house of worship and the community of faith as people, environment, people, and programs. And when that comes together to give them a meaningful experience, all right, they'll keep coming back. We believe in what we call dynamic orthodoxy as opposed to static tradition. So we believe in maintaining the principles and values of the faith that are eternal, but we deliver them, we express them, we create an environment that they can experience, be experienced in a very practical way so that it applies to daily life, but also, which is what the millennials are looking for, is for their faith to be socially applicable. Mm-hmm. They want their faith to give them a lens through which they can make sense of what's happening in the world around them, spiritually, morally, socially, politically, in every way.
You mentioned to me a while ago that with millennials, and I think it's true of others as well, give them something they value or can value, and they'll come back.
Absolutely.
They're looking for valuable connections, not just a connection.
Yeah, and our values are what we stand for, you know, what we believe is most important in life, what we're willing to pay the price for. You know, Gallup organization did a study on millennials in the workplace, and one of the things that they found is that money, how much they get paid, is second to whether the job is giving them a sense of meaning and fulfillment. That's very interesting. So no matter how much you pay them, if they don't feel that it's meaningful, if they don't feel that they're being fulfilled in that work experience, they'll move on.
You know, you mentioned to me, it was 2 weeks ago, I had called you on a Sunday. Well, I think it was Sunday, late morning, early afternoon. He said you would call me while I was delivering a sermon, and which means you were delivering a sermon using a device. And I know technology is something that is an intricate part of your service, you know, PowerPoint presentations. So talk about, you know, how you integrate the technology of today.
Well, yeah, in our faith tradition, most often the experience on a Sunday worship service is preaching as a form of communication. And there are all types and styles of preaching. But for me, I'm more of a teacher. So in that segment where the homily is given, I actually transform that auditorium of 4,000 people into my classroom. I have a digital board. I will use PowerPoint presentations from time to time to make sure it doesn't take away from, you know, what I'm saying and their attentiveness to what I'm saying. But we live in a sight and sound generation. And if we don't combine these things, our delivery, our execution of our message will not be as effective with this generation.
And you're not exactly a millennial. You and I have we're not going to be millennials, but
but I have been millennialized.
Yeah, yeah. Well put. I think that's part of it. The other thing, we don't write people off. I know there's a tendency sometimes. They're not going to come. They're not interested. And because of that mentality, people stop thinking as to what can I do better. You know, it's also very insulating to blame someone else for not coming. You know, obviously I'm doing it all well, and it's their fault, not my fault, rather than looking within and saying, what can I do differently?
And we have to think. You know, part of our philosophy has to be that change is the only constant in life. Societies change, cultures change, generations change. Our values and principles and what we communicate from our faith, that remains consistent. Those are eternal. But how we deliver the experience, how we deliver the education of it all, that has to change if it is not reaching the generation that we're trying to reach. And not only should we be reaching the generation, but generations. Because in our churches, the community is not just one segment of the society.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's from cradle to the grave that we service the family and we service society. So it's so important for us not to think so much first of what or who we need to become. First, who are we? What do we do? Are we doing it to the best of our ability? And whether it's in a house of worship or in a corporation, managing continuity and change is critical. Asking ourselves the question, what should we continue? What should we change? And knowing the difference.
So if I'm member number 36,720 in your congregation, right, and I'm going through a challenging time, how does Reverend Bernard know? How does Reverend Bernard have time to reach out to me? So community is important, but when you have such great numbers, how do you manage to keep abreast of what's going on and to have that impact?
You know, if you would see our leadership chart, you would see an inverted pyramid where the point is at the bottom, and that's myself. And at that bottom, the layer above are my division heads. The layer above that are my department heads. The layer above that are my team leaders. The layer above that are my team members. The layer above that is the congregation. The layer above that is community at large, humanity at large. And as we train them, we say, look, your greatest asset, my greatest asset are my division heads.
Mm-hmm.
I tell the division head, your greatest asset are your department heads. So moving above you are the people that are important, because ultimately, if every layer does its job right, the community, the congregation, will experience something that's going to change their life and that they will be committed to supporting.
Before I let you go, so you and I said the other day, I was quoting Rabbi Ami Hirsch. We had a meeting in Israel with the prime minister. And Ami Hirsch's phrase was that unconditional love does not mean uncritical love. That we can love a people, we can love a tradition, doesn't mean we have to withhold what we think are important concerns. It doesn't have to be this unanimity of opinion. We say often unity of spirit, but not unanimity of opinion. How do we translate that into our lives these days when we see this bifurcation, one group just slamming the other?
Well, you know, balance is a key to life. Love and truth work together. Because if we teach truth without love, we can leave people in despair. If we teach love without truth, we can lead them into presumption. So love and truth support each other. Love seeks truth. Love shapes how to speak the truth. And truth shapes how to show love. So those things work together. No matter how we try to bifurcate them in our society, we need both of them in a balanced way in order to have a healthy society.
Well, you're one of the, I find, premier pastors. You're one of the great spiritual leaders of our community, and I talk about the, you know, the great faith community we have in York. People sometimes, I don't think, appreciate the depths of our relationships with one another. We have, over the years, worked to establish a network where we talk to each other, not just during times of crisis, but, you know, every day, every other day, discussions go on, how we can strengthen one another. And I think that is a template to take elsewhere. You and I have discussed the Commission of Religious Leaders, known as CORL. We need to bring that message to so many different places. And you exemplify the best of that cooperation, and I hope we can expand it.
We complement each other. And that's, you see, that's important, because that's the principle of human dignity, all right? Being human is what establishes our dignity, not our class, not our race, not our ethnicity, none of those things. What gives us value, in fact, what makes us invaluable, is that we're each, as a human person, stamped with the image of God and worthy of dignity and respect.
We often speak of a mensch. I don't know if you ever use that in your vocabulary, but you are.
Yes, I have.
You are the mensch par excellence, and I'm just so privileged to have you as a friend. Look forward to seeing you many more times in the future as we come together to address issues of the day and just to stand shoulder to shoulder.
Thank you. Congratulations, 35 years. That's fantastic. That's a long time.
Yeah, it is. And what about the Boston Red Sox?
I'm not going to go there.
You want to talk miracle? Yeah, this is where you and I part. You know, we're friends, but okay. Have a great, great day. I always love being with you. Thanks.
God bless, my friend.
All right, Reverend A.R. Bernard, founder and senior leader of the Christian Cultural Center in Brooklyn on Long Island, two campuses.
77 WABC. Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, celebrating 35 years of Religion on the Line on 77 WABC.
This portion of Religion on the Line is brought to you by Calvary Hospital. You know, I am chaplain of FDNY, Jewish chaplain of FDNY, and I had to get special permission to have this interview. It is a great honor to go to the Carmel's Line and speak with the great police commissioner of New York. I'm referring to James B. O'Neill, who everybody really admires because he never forgot that he was a cop. And you talk to police, they always say he's a cop's cop. And I think that's a great thing, because sometimes when you rise to the top, you forget where you were. And that's something that's never escaped him. So let's go to our Carmel's Line and speak with Commissioner O'Neill. Hello, Commissioner.
Hey, Rabbi, how are you?
All the better for your asking, as the Irish say. You are you're a special guy. I know you don't like to hear all these tributes, but better to hear them now when you can hear them than at a later stage of life. There are a lot of changes that have been implemented, and one of the changes that I've witnessed is the bridging the divide that existed for too long between communities and police. When I was growing up in Massachusetts, we knew the police. They always would come around and talk to us, and they were part of the extended family. I think you have tried to bring back that spirit here in New York.
Yeah, Rabbi, I really have. And this, a lot of this has to do with my time as a transit cop, you know, way back in 1983, doing train patrol by myself from 8 at night to 4 in the morning, just talking to people in New York, and just looking at them and they're looking at me saying, oh, this guy's he makes me feel safe. And I think that's really validated my decision to become a cop. And then when I became a precinct commander, and I did that for about 6.5 years, I think that really helped me when I became police commissioner, because I know NYPD is really good at identifying where there are crime issues and a host of other challenges that we have, but that we're so much better when we work with the community. And it's got to be not just the precinct commander and not just the, you know, two community affairs cops, and they, each and every one of them, do a fantastic job, but it's got to be everybody doing the job. It's got to be the men and women in sector cars. It's got to be, you know, the anti-crime units. It's got to be everybody's got to have that same spirit, that same philosophy of neighborhood policing, that we're so much better when we have a connection to the people we're sworn to protect and serve.
So how do you implement that? I mean, I know, for example, pre-holidays in the Jewish world, we are always grateful to you for bringing us together and talking about, you know, the important connection between the precinct and people in the community, make sure that they have the synagogue schedule and they'll be patrolling the area to make sure you're safe. But on an everyday basis, how do you bring people closer so they understand each other more?
So, and that was the challenge. And we did a couple of things to help us with that. We started small. We started in Washington Heights and Inwood in the 3-3 and the 3-4, then out in Rockaway and Far Rockaway in the 100 and the 101. And we resectored those precincts into the natural neighborhoods that exist there. And we put the same sector cops in those precincts, and we created a position called the Neighborhood Coordination Officer, and there's two per sector. And they're to act as the conduit between the community and the steady sectors. And four times a year they have public safety summits. The NCOs run those meetings in their sectors. We put that out on social media. You know, we get anywhere from, you know, 50 to one sector up into 4-2. Had 400 people show up at the meeting, and the connections. You know, it's hard. What is it? It's hard to hate up close, right?
Yeah.
We're all human beings, and I think it's really a positive step forward. And I got to thank the mayor, and I got to thank the city council, because it does take more police officers to do this. You know, we want to make sure that our steady sector cops have a third of their day where they can do something besides answer 911 jobs. Give them the opportunity to make those connections too. So over the last 3 years or so, we've been able to put about 2,000 more cops out on the street, and it's really helped with the program. And we're getting real positive feedback from the community. We're getting positive feedback from the police officers, and this is a crime-fighting model because, you know, bottom line, that's what we get paid to do, fight crime and keep people safe. You know, crime is continuing to go down. We're down about a little over 1%, which is 860 crimes. Those are 860 less victims of crime in the city. We're down about 26 shootings. We're up slightly in homicide. As of this morning, we're up about 15, which is about 5-6%. But that homicide rate is about 3.4 per 100,000. And if you look at a lot of other big major cities, they're not even close to that. So, you know, the cops are doing a great job. You know, it's all about cops, crime, and community.
So crime reduction, and obviously all of us treasure those numbers. You're saying that that's attributable to some extent to the community policing, to the closer relationship in the community, that we're able to identify problem areas more quickly?
Yeah, that's the reason why we're doing this. I mean, you know, crime is at an all-time low. It was at an all-time low 4 years ago. But we knew after the Ferguson and Garner, those decisions back in 14, the protests, you know, each and every day for weeks and weeks, we knew we had to change. And Carlos Gomez was chief of patrol at the time. Then he became chief of department. Terry Monahan, Rodney Harrison. We asked a lot of our 54,000 employees, the 36,000 sworn. They know that we had to change, and they've embraced this. And now, who knows better what's going on the block than the people that live and work there and worship there? So it's we're not done. Obviously we're never going to be done, but we're really moving in a good direction.
You know, all crime is immoral, obviously, and we rail against anyone who perpetrates any criminal act. Hate crime is so egregious because you're attacking a person for who he or she is. Nothing the person has done, nothing that's, in any way angered you, but you just can't stand someone who's different according to, you know, some configuration you have in your mind. And we've had recently these hate crimes. And, you know, what do you say about them? How do we, you know, we come together, we have press conferences, and all religious leaders stand together. And by the way, what's heartening is people of all faiths come together when someone is attacked. No matter what the faith, or even if there's no faith for the person, because it's really an attack on a basic moral value.
Rabbi, as you said, there's no place for any violence in New York City, but that hate crimes are particularly egregious. And when they do happen, and, you know, we're a city of 8.6 million people, we all have to rally together. We have a this is something we take so serious that if it's a possible hate crime, we make sure that a captain and above goes to the scene. And if it is, it goes to our hate crime division, Deputy Inspector Mark Molinari. He's experienced mm-hmm. investigator, absolutely motivated to make sure that when this does happen, we bring people to justice. So it's a crime we take very seriously.
And I think, I know one of the cases you apprehended someone.
Yeah. And that's, you know, a lot of that has to do with the community too. You know, we can't be at all places at all times. And we do have, there's a lot of video out there, but when people come forward and they let us know they have video or they let us know that they're witnesses, it makes it that much better. We can get that the person who committed these heinous crimes. The sooner we can apprehend them, the less chance of it is happening again.
You know, I tell you, it's most reassuring. I know when there's been an attack on a synagogue, we look out and we see Christian, Muslim, and other religious leaders coming together and saying, we stand in solidarity with you. I remember being in many mosques and, you know, everywhere, wherever there's one, you have to be there.
Yeah.
And I think that sends a message as well. Obviously, it's not the total answer, but at least it sends a message to the community that you're not alone. We work together with police, with everyone, to say this is unacceptable, and we're going to do everything we can to bring the person to justice.
Yeah, it won't be tolerated, and that's why it's so important that to have all 8.6 million New Yorkers have respect for the police. But you know, we have to earn that respect, and you do that by making connections at the local level, the precinct commanders, the cops. The men and women are out there every day, doing the best they can, and I think they're doing a fantastic job.
So I know that you're not one who willingly accepts praise, but, you know, you've done many great things, many heralded accomplishments. Looking out, what is something that makes you so proud, and is there something else you say, we could do better?
I think this is a hard question for me. I think what I'm really proud of is the way the men and women of the NYPD have responded over the last couple of years in this change to neighborhood policing. And I'm really proud of the fact that everything that we've asked of them, the crime and violence, continues to go down. And I'm really proud of the men and women that work in the Detective Bureau. They work with the Chief of Detectives, Dermot Shea, the work they do each and every day to investigate a small percentage of the population that are out there perpetrating this violence. You know, we're working with the DAs, we're working with the U.S. attorneys, we're working with the FBI, anybody that listens to the news knows they've been beaten up a little bit, which is an understatement of the last couple of months. And I have nothing, I sing nothing but praise of the men and women of the New York FBI office. They understand what their mission is, and that's to keep the people of this city safe, and they do that so well. We have a great relationship with the ATF, the DEA, the Marshal Service. So, you know, there's a lot of great work being done by everybody. And the thing I'm most proud of is what we're doing in each and every community. And what could we do better? You know, we could do that better. You know, and it's going to get better and better over time. I had the opportunity to talk to a young cop, an NCO, neighborhood coordination officer, up in the 4-4 a couple of months ago. And he said, listen, Commissioner, this is a good program now. He said, wait till it really takes root, and this is the way everybody thinks it's going to be a different city. So I'm looking forward to that day.
If I were to tell you years ago when you began as a cop, someday you're going to be commissioner, what would you have said?
I would have said, you're out of your mind.
I think you once said to me, I didn't think I'd be on the job this long. That's what I would have said.
Yeah, my goal was, I worked for an insurance company for a couple of years. You know, I took the test and I became a transit cop, and I said, all right, this is, if I don't like it, I can always go back. But ever since those first couple of tours doing train patrol, I knew this is what I wanted to do. So I'm a lucky guy, and I've worked in some great places. I've worked with some unbelievably fantastic people, and I was lucky enough to meet Bill Bratton back in the early 90s, and he's really helped me be where I am today. And, all the men and women that I've worked with over the years, and it's thousands and thousands of people, and I thank them for their support.
And what a message it sends to every cop that, you know what, that there are opportunities out there that may be presented to you. So you never know where you're going to be. You know where you are, but who knows where you're going to be. And I think that's an inspiration to everyone to always strive to be better.
So I and I'm not going to name any names here, but I forget where we were, and it was I don't know if it was a public forum or it was an internal meeting, but somebody got up and started talking a little bit about my career, and they ended it up by saying, "See, even he can be police commissioner."
Yeah. I was at some event, and they presented me with a gift, and the person didn't think of what he was saying. He says, "Listen, this is not very much, but it shows what we think of you." So I said, "Okay, I'll take that."
Yeah, pretty much the same
thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I just returned from Israel, and I want to say to you, we had meetings all over with the highest, with the prime minister and others, and I always made it a point of talking about the relationship between New York and Israel. And everywhere I went, everyone agreed. You know, we have a lot of disagreements, but one of the things we agree on, the closeness between Israel and America, and they all said to me, when you go back, make sure you say thank you. I told them I was going to, you know, be speaking with you. Please say thank you from the people of Israel for all they do in reminding us that we're in this battle against terrorism, we're in this battle against hatred together. Yeah. And I know there have been missions to Israel by NYPD. You're in close contact with Israeli officials. They love you. You love them. And we're very proud to hear of that.
Yeah, and it is a great relationship. And it's you know, there's a couple of things that keep me up at night, and terrorism is one of them. And the way we get past this, the way we keep everybody safe, is working with everybody. You know, all New Yorkers, and you know, we have the foreign liaison program with the police foundation helps us with, and we have New York City police officers all over the world. And if anything happens, we get that information back in real time, and we do our best with that information to make sure we're keeping everybody safe. We're all in this together.
Before I let you go, you talked before we went on the air about a visit with your son to Gettysburg. Can you just talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, actually, my son went to Gettysburg College, so I've been down there a number of times, and I went down a couple weeks ago. I had the opportunity where I could actually have 2 days off in a row. I went down with two other guys. We went on an overnight motorcycle trip, and just to go down and revisit the battlefield, and you know, you see how vast that battlefield is, and the danger that was faced by the soldiers down there, and the courage to fight for what they believed in, is really, you know, it's an inspiration and this is, you know, this is how where we are, part of where we are today. You know, good or you know, you could say good or bad. You know, there's a lot of tumult in the world right now, but the United States it's more than a nation; it's an idea, and that's what we need to keep fighting for.
Now, you were riding a motorcycle, am I correct? Didn't have training wheels on it.
I've been riding a motorcycle since I was started riding dirt bikes when I was 12. So this is you know, one of my passions.
Yeah,
along with bicycling.
Yeah, I talked to motorcycle riders, and they say they love it. There's some feeling of independence when you're there, and you know, I guess you have to do it to really understand the pleasure of it.
Yeah, it's quite an experience, and when you go with your friends. I tease them all the time. Whenever I go on a motorcycle trip with my friends, I said, "It's you know, the best part about it is with your friends, you don't have to talk to them."
that's what keeps a relationship close.
That's
yeah,
right, exactly.
Yeah. What do we do about? I was coming here today to the studio. There's a guy on a skateboard texting, and he's on the sidewalk. And you know, you look at this behavior of some of the bikers. And the skateboarders, and you say, my God, even walking on a sidewalk can be dangerous.
Yeah, it's, you know, people, it's, I talk about this being a shared responsibility all the time. You know, people have to not just look out for themselves, they have to look out for everybody else. And, you know, you see people with their heads down and not paying attention to what's going on. And that's not good for a couple of reasons. You know, we need to pay attention to our surroundings, not just to keep ourselves safe from simple things, but you know, if you've got your head up and you're looking around and you see something that makes you uncomfortable, you know, if you think there's something wrong, I think you have a responsibility to dial 911 or flag down a cop so we can give us a chance to investigate it, and that's how all New Yorkers can help keep us safe.
So I began the program kiddingly saying that I needed permission to speak to you because I'm with FDNY as a chaplain, but the truth of the matter is, you work closely with FDNY. You and Commissioner Nigro are good friends, and it's inspiring to see that. Because, you know, you hear all the stories. They really don't like each other. They just, you know, put on act. It's not true. So thank you.
Yeah, it certainly is. And Dan is a great leader and a fine human being. And I think what changed this is after Detective Lou and Ramos were mm-hmm. murdered back in 2014 and the outpouring of support we received from the fire department will never be forgotten. I'll always be thankful for.
I thank you. You're a valued friend, and thanks for being on today. And just, you know, I don't know how we can say thank you better, but I always make it a point of going over police and saying just thank you for your service. Thank you for keeping us safe.
And they all appreciate it, Rabbi.
Yeah. Well, and a big thank you to you, of course, Police Commissioner James P. O'Neill.
Anytime, Rabbi. Take care.
Bye-bye.
77 WABC. Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, celebrating 35 years of religion on the line on 77 WABC.
As we come to the end of the program, I mentioned earlier that I returned from Israel this past week, going there with members of the rabbinate, with 21 rabbis, all different faith communities representing different denominations. And the message that we heard from Israelis was a consistent one, and that is say thank you to America. Say thank you for establishing finally Jerusalem as the capital. Say thank you for withholding funding for UNRWA, which supports Palestinian terrorism, because you look at the textbooks, what they teach the kids, but above all, our gratitude, our boundless gratitude for all that Israel has received from America. We are most, most thankful. So let me get those words out today to all of you, and we deeply appreciate the commitment that's been made throughout the years. This is Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
77 WABC.